So talking about the Heart Sutra today, I wondered why, with the Heart Sutra being the shortest of these source materials for our Zen circle, why that was saved for the end. And I'm kind of glad I had so much time to reflect on it and do research, because there is a whole lot there. And I think that it really makes sense that it's near the end here, because its connections to the Zen circle are pretty remarkable. We're all familiar with it. We just chanted it about half an hour ago, and probably most of us can recite it from memory. I mean, my experience chanting it is I listen to the words, and it doesn't really hang together as a whole coherent piece of teaching, but in reading about it, it sure has. I referred to a few sources, read a few books on it. The first one, and I'm going to be holding things up here. Maybe that's not in focus. Here we go. Edward Kahn's Buddhist Wisdom Books. Has Diamond Sutra and Heart Sutra from 1958. Red Pine has a translation of the Heart Sutra from 2004. And Rinzai Zen Master Hakuin wrote a commentary on the Heart Sutra. This translation is called Zen Words for the Heart, but the accurate translation would be Poison Words for the Heart. And then Zen Master Sungsan, in his book, Compass of Zen, has a chapter on the Heart Sutra, which was really helpful. So with regard to the translations, some of them have been from Sanskrit, and some of them seem to come from Chinese. And I think the Sanskrit ones tend to be a lot more technical sounding, and these efforts to get the exact meanings of words, and the Chinese ones give the opportunity. I think it's a little bit more flexible and can be a little bit more poetic. The one that we do, and this is from a little piece at the Kansas Zen Center site by Judy Reitman and Stan Lombardo, but it was done by Peter Schneider and Ryogen Yoshimura under the supervision of Shunryu Suzuki. So probably in the 70s or late 60s, I would guess. I also did a little bit of playing around. I found the Chinese characters for the Heart Sutra and tried to feed them into Google Translate. And Google Translate does not get the Heart Sutra. It was just mostly gibberish, but I did learn a few interesting things from that exercise. The Heart Sutra has a structure that's similar to what would be a typical sutra, but it's very short, probably better described as a Dharani. And Paul gave that talk last year on the Great Dharani. Describing sort of what the features of a Dharani are. There's a mantra at the end as well. And I won't even try to define those things, but it is extremely, it's probably the most widely recognized, well-known piece of Buddhist literature, scripture, chanted daily or more than daily in all Zen centers and in the Tibetan tradition as well, probably written sometime between 200 and 400 AD or Common Era, probably originally in Sanskrit, although there's some disagreements about that. It could have been written in Chinese. There was a version in around 400 by Kumarajiva, but the most famous one that was adopted was the one by Xuanzang in 629. And if you've never heard of Xuanzang, His dates roughly overlap the fifth Zen patriarch, Hung Jin. He set out to India to get the scriptures, and he's extremely legendary in Chinese history for doing that. He returned 17 years after setting out on foot for India, and translated a lot of the sutras that he brought back. Interestingly, so we watched a movie over the weekend about Xuanzang that was produced in 2016 by the China Film Corporation, and beautiful scenery of the Silk Road, something that you might want to check out. The writing of the Heart Sutra is considered part of the wisdom literature of the New Wisdom School, the Madhyamika School of Nagarjuna, probably written in this area, the Kushan Empire, Pakistan, Afghanistan. If you ever wondered how those Buddhas got on the cliffs in Afghanistan, this was a period where Buddhism was very active, thriving in that region. And it was along the Silk Road, so it really facilitated communication back and forth with China and these Buddhist schools. The Madhyamika school emphasized the concept of shunyata, or emptiness, and that is the huge theme in the Heart Sutra, of course. It was probably a reaction to a slightly earlier school or a school at the same time called the Sarvastivadin school. They were undertaking a project of developing this kind of a psychology almost of Buddhism, where these facts of existence were being defined very carefully. So, and these were classified as various dharmas that were recognized to be true. And the Madhyamikas were with the emphasis on emptiness. So that means emptiness of any sense of self, any kind of separate existence or own being. So in the previous talks, we heard about how there are these themes of interconnectedness, nothing really having a separate independent and permanent existence. And so that was a theme that was very much emphasized. I'm not really going to talk too much about sort of the setup to the Heart Sutra with Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra and all that, but I will say a few things about the title. The Prajna Paramita Sutras are considered wisdom sutras. Prajna is usually translated as wisdom, but the roots, Prajna, pra meaning before, and wisdom, or and jna meaning to know. So before knowing, or probably matches our idea of before thinking mind. Prajna, you can really think about, or yeah, prajna, you can understand that as before thinking. Same roots in Greek create the word prognosis, interestingly. So before thinking, or don't know mind in our tradition. The term paramita, commonly translated as perfection, so perfection of wisdom, but it has two etymologies. The first, parama, is the perfection translation, but a more creative yet widely reported one divides paramita into para and mita, with para meaning beyond, the further bank, shore, or boundary, and mita meaning that which has arrived, or ida, that which goes. So paramita in that sense, that which has gone beyond, that which goes beyond or transcendent. So that really matches how the Prajnaparamita is understood in a lot of translations. And then, so it starts out then with Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. There's this part that Red Pine makes a point of saying, there's this little, one little syllable that's like, oh, Shariputra, or here, Shariputra. And Red Pine says that directly relates to this third Buddhist council in 267 BC or something like that, where they agreed that a person could become awakened by a loud noise or startle. So the Zen master Katz has a long history, and apparently that one syllable at the beginning of that teaching relates to that. Goes on to talk about the five skandhas and dharmas. So skandhas are sort of the things that are considered real components of experience. So that we have a sense of there not being a real self, but there are all these components of experience that can be considered real. Form is just sort of everything that's kind of material and out there. And then the other four being more psychological constructs, feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness, and consciousness in that sense meaning kind of discriminating consciousness rather than sort of big mirror consciousness. There were other dharmas developed by the Sarvastivadins. You know, example, mindfulness, vigor, envy, you know, other psychological constructs, but considered to be real. But the challenge to that was that, well, yeah, they might be real in a way, but kind of, this is still all thinking. They're all being defined in such a way that this is really a verbal conceptual model of what's out there. On our Zen circle, then that's thinking eye, 90 to 180, and the challenge was that was kind of incomplete. So the sutra goes on to say that all these dharmas are marked with emptiness. So not having a sense of own of being in themselves, and connected to all other dharmas as part of a bigger whole. It goes on, as we know, to say no, you know, that no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. So all these no's, the Chinese character is the word wu. And in our Kung'an collection, we have the preliminary Kung'ans and then the primary gates. And the very first primary gates is this Kung'an about Chow Chow's wu. And I will read that. A monk once asked Chow Chow, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Chow Chow answered, wu, and which typically means no. But as we know in Kung'an practice, simple one-sided opposites version of language is seldom adequate. So in Rinzai Zen, this is always the first Kung'an, and this familiarity with wu or mu in the Japanese tradition is emphasized as an experiential thing to really get a sense of what we sometimes call the absolute or emptiness, which Zheng Ji has described as spacious awareness, getting a real feeling for that. So it's with that sense that this, that there's this exercise in the Heart Sutra, that idea of emptiness and the experience of emptiness is applied to all these major aspects of Buddhism. And it just goes right through all these Buddhist concepts, the five skandhas, form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness, and then on to the 18 dhatus of sensation. So they were really very interested in perception and perceptual psychology, those aspects of experience. And then goes on right into the 12-length chain of dependent origination and its interruption. Those are all empty. So that's the ignorance to old age and death, with all the other 10 links in between those links. And then finally, it goes on to suffering, origination, stopping, path. Those are one word descriptions of the Four Noble Truths: the truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the stopping of suffering, the path, the eightfold path of the stopping of suffering. And then knowledge and attainment. So that's an interesting part where it ends up there. And then it goes on from there to the next stanza about the Bodhisattva relying on Prajnaparamita. The way our Heart Sutra is written, it ends with no attainment, with nothing to attain. But you could kind of parse that differently. And depending on the translation, some are no attainment, full stop. With nothing to attain, the Bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita. And those kind of have different senses. You could also think about, I think it's easiest, the most conventional understanding of nothing to attain is that, you know, the whole project doesn't really involve that much. You're not going to get anything from this practice. But you could also say that you might attain nothing, and attaining nothing might be a great thing. So in any case, moving on to that next section, that is what would map to the Zen circle as 180. Attainment of nirvana. So the other interesting parts in that section have to do with this no hindrance. The mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. So this hindrance is translated in various ways. Red Pine says walls of the mind. It really seems to describe sort of the thinking, what thinking offers in terms of structuring our experience, but also allowing us to ignore certain things in our experience and letting go of that. One of the things about emptiness is that it really can sound kind of scary and has this aspect of annihilation that I think could be kind of scary. And I think this no fears exist sort of gets at that this isn't really a scary place to be in, this before thinking place. And it really is in the sutra identified with this is nirvana. That's the goal of the Hinayana. And of course, so this is a Mahayana sutra, so the idea is to move beyond that, to follow the bodhisattva ideal to enlightenment and enlightened action to save beings. The one other thing about sort of there's without any hindrance, no fears exist. It also, to me, that really triggers this idea of great freedom, that not only would I not feel hindered by anything, but that and what do we usually think about? Things that hold us back, rules that hinder us, and but what's the other thing is sort of this internal hesitance, this inhibition, fears. So no rules, no fears, and no inhibitions. And I'm not sure that it really allows that. It reminded me, Zen master Jibong used to often quote John Cage, who I guess at one point had some exhibit that said, "Permission granted, but not to do whatever you want." So somehow I think that that's connected there. Okay, so nirvana attained, 180. But then we go right on from there to, all the Buddhas of the past, present, and future go right on from there to attain Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, unexcelled perfect enlightenment. So on our Zen circle, that is truth world, where everything just appears as it is. It's not mediated by our thinking. Our thinking is still active, but we're not attached to it, and we can perceive the world. We can perceive truth, and then finally proceeding to this gate parasam gate bodhisvaha, which translates to gone beyond, gone completely beyond, awake. Well said. So in the compass of Zen master Sung San says that really is the full realization moment world. That means just do it. That is activity. That is really fulfilling our bodhisattva action function. In that there is this other interesting kind of aspect that I don't see anywhere in the text, but it's understood that prajnaparamita is kind of personified in some ways at the end there, and is described as the womb of Buddhas. And so somehow there's this mantra is a gift from prajnaparamita, and making use of it leads to Buddhahood. So it's this wonderful thing that takes us to the other shore, as described with that understanding of prajnaparamita. And maybe that's all I will say about the Heart Sutra, and we could, I think, have a conversation about it. I get the one question that I had is that in mapping to the Zen circle, we talked in previous sessions about that there's not some sort of steady progression from 0 to 90 to 180 and back around, and that we might occupy different points on the Zen circle at different times. But the question that comes to mind for me is, how do we use this to apply our effort? Where do we, how do we use this model to say, okay, I need to develop my conceptual ideas about Buddhism, and or I need to sort of really aim at that 180. Getting to 180 really activates the whole circle and makes it all possible. Are we really trying to go around in a 0 to 360 kind of way, or are there other ways to exert our efforts? Anyway, on that topic or anything else, why don't we do questions and discussion?
Jim, I gotta unmute us all, or?
Let's see. I think in the past I have people kind of raise their hands and then I unmute, but let's see. I might not be fully have all the host powers because I'm not seeing where I can. Oh wait. I see. I just have to.
I was able to unmute myself in any case.
Yes, you can all unmute yourselves if need be. Go ahead if you'd like.
Well,
Catherine,
I really liked we talked about freedom. And I've always connected that with the Heart Sutra. And especially freedom regarding, kind of freedom from ideas, which aren't, necessarily good or bad, but can in this certain situations be limiting. I liked the part that you mentioned, freedom. There was something else I was going to say, but I can't remember.
Jeff.
I think something that intrigues me particularly is that the base of our whole practice, you might even say the base of the Buddha Dharma, is experience, direct experience. There is such a history and tradition of all these different understandings. And the Heart Sutra cuts through and disqualifies, one by one, every way that we might conceptualize what this life, what this moment, what this world is, what we are. Our famous Zen circle, what is this? And so I admire how completely thorough it is. And I think a line that really stands out for me is no attainment with nothing to attain. So there goes hope. it's brilliant. And I think it's easy to get caught up in you could call it complexity, but I think it's just being very thorough in disarming, diffusing anywhere we might develop a fixed view, which is very, which is limiting and just not true. So that's why I like it. I like that about it. I really enjoy your talk too, Jim. It's really, you did some good historic research.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I will say it is very thorough in sort of wiping out all these ideas. One of the things that Red Pine kind of went on about a little bit was that in the translations that we have, it doesn't explicitly wipe out the idea of time, but that had been in there originally.
Mm.
John.
It's interesting that you mentioned time. I was thinking about, time is a real interesting subject to me. And and Einstein and the theory of relativity and space and time. And in it, it's quite clear that time is relative. And it really hit me. Anything that's relative is empty. So time is empty, beyond a doubt. So I can see why it was very appropriate. It would have been very appropriate to stick in the Heart Sutra.
Yeah, he said that it's still kind of in there in the Sanskrit. I think it says, with no attainment and no non-attainment, and then goes on to say with nothing to attain. But his point was that going from non-attainment to an attainment is a description of a process over time. And so saying that neither of those things exist also means that there's no time. Anya, did you have a question? You're on.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for very interesting information what I just heard today. And my thought was about nothing to attain. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Nothing to attain. Very important to me is because the thought of kind of chaos in life, and you feel like you pretty much always have to resolve something and think about and plan. And it's nice to know that you don't have to always do that. And by the way, it can bring you peace, which I learned with new skills, meditating, and it's really appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I think, yeah, it does say that Prajna Paramita can provide that refuge, but on Sunday morning, Son Sunim was reading out of Ta Wei, or quoting Ta Wei, and saying that that we ought to be proceeding as though we owe some great huge debt that we can never hope to repay. So there's some kind of pressure as well. There's refuge when you need it, but then there's this exhortation to act and to really try hard.
I see. So I guess my understanding was not exactly what it is, right?
No, you're right. It's there's that part of it that there's that refuge.
Oh, yes. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Meg here, and that is it is kind of a contradiction, non-contradiction. Doesn't it seem kind of like nothing to attain, so there's no point of success, and yet we do talk about that 0 to 360, that having your mind more in a state of non-attainment in a way. So it's almost like attaining non-attainment is really the goal without really being you know, but it's not a goal. It is a little, but it's not, but what is it, right? What is non-attainment? It's not attainment.
I agree.
Well, you could say that 0 and 360, they're the same place. So, you know, you're already there. And
right?
There's really nothing that you need to do. But then there's at the end of the Heart Sutra, it's the gone beyond. So there is, you can't just stay in the one spot at 0 degrees.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's like you don't go in it, you know, you're moving so fast to go nowhere at all. It kind of reminds me, so I read this other meditation scholar a while back, and he was speaking to a room of students, and he said, "You all want to be Superman overnight, you know?" And it's like and so but we are all supermen overnight in a way. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing that, no place we have to go, nothing we have to do. You know, we can do it right here, right now, in this moment. We just have to, what was that? Give up all our desires. And that's all.
All right, Claire, anyway. You have your hand up.
I wanted to talk about this no attainment with nothing to attain. This is my favorite part of the Heart Sutra, and it's particularly important for me and my personality. I'm a very type A personality, and my whole life has been delayed gratification and attaining this and attaining this and attaining this. And when I came to Zen, it was because I was realizing that with all the attainments that I had, I still was miserable. And in order to release this constant drive, this constant grasping, and to want to achieve something, I was repeating in my mind over and over again, nothing to attain, no attainment, nothing to attain. You don't have to be anything. You don't have to be anything. And one of my favorite books by Thich Nhat Hanh is called Nothing to Do, Nowhere to Go. And it's awesome. I read it several times and underlined it and highlighted it and bought myself a copy. And it's been really earmarked because for myself, it's very, very helpful for me to tell myself, particularly during isolation, you don't have to accomplish anything. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to do anything. You are perfect just the way you are.
Well, that's true, but you still have to save all beings. I think that at least the heart, I mean, what it at least offers is this refuge, this space where that is the case. Sean.
Yeah. You know, it can be slippery. I personally very much appreciate that our practice includes a dichotomy, you know, or in contradiction. You know, because I think at a pretty fundamental level, our world does, and we kind of apprehend those aspects.
Well, this is a great conversation, and it's a topic that I think we've all wrestled with or been practicing with continuously. On one hand, no attainment with nothing to attain, and on the other hand, there's the prescription of moment world that is always changing. And always we have a job to do. So it's that that dichotomy, that contradiction of, you know, you really described it very well, Claire, I think, when you were talking about, you know, you hear this teaching, no attainment with nothing to attain. So it reminds you of your job, and which is to be present. And being present and relaxing with that and taking refuge in that is already saving all beings. All done. So these words in the sutras, they can really inspire us and help us to find our refuge and find our fitting, appropriate action in the moment. It's all already there, and it's a lovely practice.
Silk.
On one other, just a quick question. Oh, and I'm sorry, I probably interrupted. But if you could, I really enjoyed this talk, Jim. It was terrific. And I'm intrigued by this film that you mentioned. Maybe you could put it in or just type it into the chat. So those of us who are interested, we could check it out.
Oh yeah, sure. It's on YouTube. Let's see. I don't know if I know how to do chat, but I will try.
Go ahead, Gerald, in the meantime.
Sorry, I'm being too polite. I just had a joke, which I think is from Jibong Sansa. I'm going to attribute it to him and hope my memory is correct. He said, if you really want to understand the impact of the Heart Sutra, show it to a very devout Theravadan practitioner, and then you have the Heart Attack Sutra, because essentially you've knocked out every pillar of orthodoxy and traditional Theravadan Buddhism. And I have to say that because I started not with Zen, but with more Vipassana style insights, spent a lot of time reading sutras, got very invested in the Eightfold Path and that sort of thing, I still find the Heart Sutra a little bit disturbing in a sense, because of that quality of it. So I'm still challenged when I look at that text and even when I say those words. But then don't get too attached to the words that you're saying. You know, the other thing is I loved your question about how we map that onto the Zen circle and how we actualize that teaching in our life. I sometimes say that when I encounter these teachings, I feel provoked. And again, you know, I'm provoked by your question, because it is very easy to go off in a very esoteric direction with this. And then I hear Claire's voice saying, no, just, it's not that difficult. So, anyway, I thought it was a great talk. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. And I can't figure out chat, but, Z-U-A-N, no, wait, X, I'm sorry, X-U-A-N-Z-A-N-G.
X-U-A-N.
Z-A-N-G.
Z-A-N-G. I'll just send it to everybody.
Thank you.
There you go. I think I did it. I think I spelled it right.
Yes, it's all one word in the YouTube movie title. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, anybody else have anything they'd like to say? And I got